Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Just in case anybody hasn't read it, the book is... Oh, I've forgotten. The book is Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, by Tavris and Aronson. And it's all about cognitive dissonance and self-justification. One of my favourite concepts, and also one of the ones you learn very, very early in your psychology training, practically, and I certainly remember learning about it in sixth form. So it's one of the kind of key cornerstone psychological concepts that really emerges over and over and over and over again. And I think what's really interesting about this book is that it really demonstrates how commonplace it is, but also because it's so commonplace, why don't we all know a little bit more about it? Because it really does seem to affect so much of our lives. And hopefully that's something that we'll be able to get into in the discussion this evening. And so I only got a couple of questions in, so do feel free to drop your questions in. Otherwise, it will just be me lecturing at you. So just so that you don't get bored or feel fatigued from hearing my voice drone on about things that I think are interesting. And I don't want to miss anything that you guys might have questions about. But always worth starting with a definition. And so cognitive dissonance is a sense of psychic or mental unease that emerges from holding two opposing sets of beliefs at the same time. And it's particularly strong when one of those beliefs is about our character, our self-concept, or our tribal affiliations. So a low-level example would be something like, let's say I believe that smoking is a filthy habit, it's disgusting, only silly people smoke, why would you do it if you know what harm, you know, all of that set of beliefs. So I think smoking is bad, but then I meet someone whom I think is really smart and really interesting, and I kind of really aspire to be like them, and I wish, you know, I could hang out with them a lot more. And then, you know, woe of woes, I discover that they are a smoker. And so I have these opposing beliefs in mind. One is that smoking, that only silly people smoke. And the other is, well, this person that I think is very smart and attractive and interesting is a smoker. And cognitive dissonance theory says, I have to find a way of easing that discomfort of those opposing views. I have to find a way of making it less dissonant and less difficult for myself. And so I have to do something with one of those beliefs. And so I can either say to myself, maybe smoking isn't so bad. Maybe, you know, I need to just kind of ease up on it. Maybe it is a bit cool. And so I have to change my belief about the smoking, or I change my belief, shift my belief about the other person. I say, well, obviously they're not as smart as I thought they were. Obviously, actually, I don't think they're that attractive. So I have to find a way of, or, you know, so the theory and by and large, I will find a way of trying to ease this dissonance so that I don't have to hold such opposing beliefs. Now, where the book goes to at the end, and one of the things that we talk about a lot in psychology is actually, can we learn to tolerate dissonance? Can we learn to either not hold our beliefs as strongly, that's a difficult one, but can we learn to sit in the shades of grey? And if you guys have been following my Black and White Thinking series, the Thinking in Public series and all of that, then you'll know that this is one of the real skills of social life and of, I guess, mature discussion is can I sustain and can I hold these opposing views? Can I hold them lightly? And can I not turn it into us against them, not turn it into a war, but can I see some shade of grey, some middle position, some compromise, or can I just tolerate the dissonance? So that's the definition of cognitive dissonance. And it's very likely that reading the book, you would have experienced some dissonance in yourself. And I think one of the really most interesting and relevant points to come out of the book is how unreliable memory is. And it's one of the things that we learn very early in psychology training, particularly around eyewitness testimony and how much of the legal system used to rely on eyewitness testimony, because we believe the underlying theory of memory used to be that your mind would hold essentially almost like a video record of the events, that you would just kind of remember it as is, and then you just kind of reproduce it exactly as it is whenever you're telling that story. And actually doesn't seem to work like that. What happens when you remember something is that you're reconstructing it. You have a couple of pieces that might be real or true or kind of close, and then the rest is a reconstruction. And so every time you retell a story, it shifts ever so slightly. So sometimes, you know, you might be telling a story and you think, actually, I don't know if I remember being there or whether I saw a picture of me there. You know, or I can't remember who told me this, but I remember. So you remember fragments and pieces of it, but you don't necessarily remember it as an exact facsimile, as an exact replication of the events that happened. And one of the big classic studies in eyewitness testimony was one in which, and I think they talk about it in the book, is where you can actually influence someone's estimation of the speed of a vehicle crash, a vehicle collision, by changing the words. So what the researchers did was to take different groups of people and they showed them a video of a road traffic accident. And with one group, they said, "What could you estimate what speed the vehicles were traveling when they collided?" And then with the other group, they said, "Could you tell me or estimate what speed the vehicles were traveling when they crashed?" And just this shift in word, saying crashed instead of collided, gave the sense that it was a much higher speed than they'd seen. So the people who heard the word crash made much higher estimations than the people who heard the word collide. And then what they showed, so this is Loftus and, this is literally going back 20 years, Palmer and Loftus, I think. Then what they did was they were able to implant false memories of things that were on the video. So they would say, and how much glass was there in the crash, or where did it fall? And people would say, oh yeah, there was this much glass, or it was the left side window smashed, and actually no glass is smashed, there hadn't been a problem, or there hadn't been any broken glass. So they were able to implant these false memories. And that really shook psychology. It was a really landmark study in psychology because it really demonstrated how unreliable our memories were. And it meant that convictions that had been perhaps based a lot on the strength of an eyewitness testimony were now very, very questionable. And it's no longer seen as a kind of very strong piece of evidence in order to convict. So those are really important things to remember, because quite often we can feel very confident of our memories. And what happens a lot in therapy is that people will say, well, I'm not sure how, you know, if it's exactly true. And that's a relevant point. And often actually what we're thinking about in therapy is the emotional resonance. You know, we don't need to know exactly, pinpoint 100% what happened. But what tends to be more accurate is the emotional resonance. That's what we tend to deal with, rather than trying to get you to absolutely accurately recreate the past or the scenario or the situation or the question. So one of the other things that I thought was very, very important was this difference between error and responsibility. So we quite often think we don't like to make mistakes and we don't like to be found out if we do make a mistake. I think they raise a very interesting difference right at the end between the American schooling system and the Japanese schooling system where it came to learning about maths. And what they said was, in the Japanese classroom, a little boy was struggling with an equation or a problem for about 40 minutes. And he was just gently encouraged. And if he made a mistake, it was fine. And then he eventually got there and his whole class cheered him. You know, everyone was supporting him. And it was understood that mistakes were simply part of the process. They were necessary, absolutely required in order for him to get the answer, that it's just part of the process. Whereas they said that in the American schooling system, because so much is about testing, that the idea of making mistake becomes very, very threatening and very worrying. And again, also, I guess, because it's a very individualistic society, as is the UK, that there is a huge amount of shame in making a mistake and getting something wrong. And it's not seen as part of the problem. It's seen as a sign that you're not cut out for it. You just don't have the capacity for this particular thing. And that can make the difference between persisting, continuing with something until you get it, and quitting. And that makes a huge difference with any kind of aspect of success, right? That one of the things that came up quite recently, and I put in my book, was a study which found not only is failing part of success, it is a prerequisite for success. It's absolutely necessary. You have to fail before you succeed. And so the idea that we feel so anxious and shamed by anything that looks like failure actually gets in the way of our opportunities to succeed. So a very slight segue, but thinking about that difference between error and responsibility, so that if we can move away from seeing error or mistakes as something to be ashamed of, and more something to either learn from or something that we then have the opportunity to demonstrate responsibility for, then it becomes something much less threatening, much less frightening, and much less something that we will then have to try to defend against through self-justification and trying, you know, kind of doubling down on our position. So that was something else. So one of the questions that came in, which was very good and very, what's the word, emphatic, was, how do I tell someone they are self-justifying without making them furious? And this is an excellent question. So let's start from the position of, when someone is self-justifying and they're experiencing cognitive dissonance, particularly where it pertains to their sense of self, their self-concept, or their tribal affiliation, there is a very high risk that they will fall into this black and white position, right? So, which is a very highly defended position. So that's your opening, that should be your opening assumption, is that if I can see that someone is self-justifying, it's likely that they feel a part of their self-concept or their self-esteem is under threat, and they are going to be very likely or have a quite high tendency to defend themselves. And what that means is that they're much more likely to perceive any disagreement as an attack, which will then make them defend themselves even more. So let's take an example. So let's say that I am sitting down with an MP who has just voted not to extend free school meals during the summer to children during a pandemic, right? So we can imagine the scenario, which is that, let's say I'm the MP, and I say, so belief number one, I am a kind, compassionate, thoughtful person. I'm a good parent, and I care about children. So that's my belief number one. Belief number two, the dissonant belief, is hunger is bad, or children are vulnerable, children should be protected. However, I know that I voted against extending free school meals. So now I have these dissonant positions in my mind. And like where I started out with the beliefs about smoking and meeting this attractive smoker, I need to find a way to ease that dissonance. And so what's unlikely is that I'm unlikely to say, actually, I'm not a very good person, or I'm not a very compassionate person, or I'm not very kind. You know, that's going to be a threat to my self-concept, my self-esteem, and we're very, very highly motivated to protect our self-esteem. So that's not really an option. For some people, it's an option. Some people will kind of dismiss themselves, but for most people, that's not the option. So I have to do something with this belief. I have to do something with hunger is bad, children should be protected, da-da-da-da-da. And so what I might say is something like, hunger isn't that bad, or the extent of the problem is being over-exaggerated, or, well, the other guys didn't do anything about it either, so it's not my, you know, who's really at fault here, or it was worse when the other guys were in charge, so, you know, don't blame me, or feckless parents. I might say, well, it's not my problem, it's the parents' problem. So all of these things would be my attempt to ease the dissonance that I was experiencing. It'd be a way of holding on to my self-esteem, my self-concept, whilst seeing that I behaved in a way that seemed to go against that. So we've laid out our scenario. How would I... Going back to the question, how do you tell someone that they're self-justifying without making them furious? And remembering your opening assumption, which is if someone is self-justifying, then it means they're likely to feel very at threat, under attack, or defensive. And so it does not help to lead with a criticism or attack. It doesn't help to shout, hurl abuse, criticize, be angry, because that will just force that person right back into their fortress and really motivate them to justify themselves even more. So it's absolutely no man's land. It will not work. So criticism doesn't work. Lecturing doesn't work. What is much more effective is to lead with empathy. And so let's say someone says, well, my parents had nothing when I was a kid and I never went hungry. I might say, that's great. I'm actually really, really glad that that was your experience. I think one less adult who had an experience of childhood hunger is a really good thing. It would be great if that were the case for more and more people. And you were clearly very, very fortunate to have the parents that you had or the situation that you were in. I wonder though, whether alongside your recollections of your own experience, I wonder whether you can also hold in mind the possibility that not everyone or not all children are as lucky as you were, right? So it's I'm saying basically the same thing as good for you, you know, but in a way that is actually empathetic to their position, understanding what they're saying, and being genuinely curious about where they are in their thinking. So my position becomes one of, well, I understand my mind and I'd like to understand yours better. And what that tends to do is to bring down their defenses. It brings down or reduces the likelihood that they're going to kind of, you know, put their shields up and be ready to fight me. Because what I've said is, you know, I've made that first step across no man's land, right? I've said, I'm not here to fight. You know, I'm coming over in peace. I just want to know what's going on in your mind. And then that opens up the space for thinking. When we're defended, it's like the space for thinking completely closes. But when we feel understood, then the space for thinking opens up. So how how to tell someone they're just self-justifying without making them furious. Don't tell them. So manage your tone. Don't go into a position of moral superiority. That's not going to help. Approach with empathy. Try to be genuinely curious, like hone your own curiosity and ask questions, right? Just tell me what you think. What's going on? What's that all about? And then hopefully, and usually, their defenses come down. All right. So I'm going to go back to one of your questions. In a Russian school, one is shamed in a collectivist way for lowering the common score of the class. Oof. Don't know if that's better or worse. Well, I mean, shame in any, you know, shame is an unhelpful emotion. Shame is, it's an evolved emotion, by which I mean shame doesn't seem to be associated with any one particular culture. It seems to be general across cultures, whether that's industrial cultures or more agricultural or traditional cultures. And so we think that it's really an evolved mechanism and that, shame emerges as a way of preventing us doing anything that will get us kicked out of the tribe, because to be kicked out of a tribe is to become incredibly vulnerable. Certainly in our evolutionary context, you know, to be isolated and have to fend for oneself means you're incredibly vulnerable and you're at risk. And so shame evolved as a mechanism to help us avoid doing things that would either get us kicked out and or punished. And what they find in cross-cultural studies is that if you get people to imagine different intensities of shameful actions. So how ashamed would you feel if you stole some bread from your neighbor versus how ashamed would you feel if you kissed your neighbor's partner? The intensity of the shame correlates to the intensity of the punishment that others would say that they would give out. So it's almost as if we're able to track the intensity of the badness of the things that we do and to limit those sorts of things. But the problem with shame, as opposed to guilt, so guilt and shame are often mistaken for each other. The difference with shame tends to be a sense of I am bad, there's something wrong with me, I'm fundamentally broken, versus guilt, which tends to be I've done something wrong, I've hurt someone, I've done something bad. And so guilt leads more to reparation. I've done something bad. What can I do to fix it? Whereas shame tends to lead to withdrawal. I am bad. I'm worthless. I shouldn't be here. I'm not good enough to be here. Let me just remove myself from this situation. So shame as a teaching technique, would not recommend. Shame tends to sit with people for a very, very long time. And so much of the work that we do in therapy is trying to get people to relinquish the unfair burden of shame. The other thing that I've highlighted is the importance of staying open to feedback. And I say this because it's certainly one of the teaching tools. So one of the most galling things about training to be a psychologist is group supervisions during your training. And what happens is that you present a session word for word. You have to just put it all down. And often, you know, when you've said something and you know you said something really dumb or just like really clumsy or just wrong, or, you know, there's been a not very good response. But usually that goes away and those thoughts stay in your head. But in training, basically everyone gets the opportunity to talk to you about the stupid thing you just said for years. And it's really tough, but essentially it's about making you better, right? And it always made me laugh when I was on the Bake Off and you do your little VTs after the bake, you know, so you've done the bake and they take you outside the tent and they're like, okay, so how did it go? Or they'll go, that didn't go very well, did it? How did it feel to get the feedback from Paul? He was quite mean to you, wasn't he? And I was like, yeah. And, you know, that it was, I was like, I'm so used to getting much worse feedback about things that matter so much more than cake that honestly, I don't mind. It's all right. So the ability to tolerate feedback just makes you much more robust. And the ability to separate what you've done from who you are is really an important skill, right? Because I think what often happens is that people will take, again, because we see failure or mistakes as something to be ashamed of rather than something to learn from, that we take that on as a sign that we are fundamentally flawed rather than that we're just human and we're learning and we're getting better and that this is an essential process. And if we can be open to it and not defensive, we'll just get better. So I think so many more people need to be able to do that, and or that we shift our entire society, but you know, that we start having more conversations around the idea that mistakes are an essential part of being human and that we all experience it and it's really no big deal. And often no one will remember, or the mistake becomes something that you laugh about later, you know, having things slightly more in perspective. I'm going to go back to your questions. Is it possible to feel guilty unconsciously? For example, blaming yourself unconsciously if things don't go as expected or from other people's feelings.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So certainly in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, we talk about an unconscious sense of guilt. And certainly in particular around offending behavior. And I will talk a little bit about this because that's why I started my career working in prisons. And what you find, for example, is that some people just always feel bad, always. It doesn't matter what's happened. It doesn't really matter whether it was their fault or not. Sometimes, even when something goes well for them, they can find a way of making themselves feel bad about it. Undeserving. I've taken something away from somebody else. It shouldn't be me. I shouldn't have got that promotion. You know, somehow they always end up feeling bad. And from an analytic perspective, so that's, you know, one of the different schools of therapy, we might think, you know, not for everybody, but for some people, there might be this unconscious sense of guilt that somewhere deep inside them, this person carries a sense of shame or a sense of having, of being faulty, of not being good enough. And that kind of generalizes out into everything else. And so they can't really pinpoint it. They can't attach it to anything. You know, if they were able to hook it on, oh, well, it was because 2 years ago I, you know, cheated on my partner, that's why I feel like a bad person. Because if it were that, then they'd be able to resolve it, right? If you could hook it on a single activity, experience, relationship, then it becomes something that's resolvable or processable. But when it's just this kind of unconscious sense of guilt, then it just feels much more ambiguous, much more kind of ethereal, and it just kind of pervades every aspect of their being, and that they end up just feeling bad. And that can be really tricky because at that point, it's almost as if the person's just taking it on as truth. Like, I'm a bad person, and it doesn't matter what you say because I'm a bad person. And if you really knew, then you would know that I was a bad person. But why are you a bad person? I just am, you know. And it becomes this kind of thing that is kind of a slippery concept that you can't really get your hands on. And that's when you might think that there might be an unconscious sense of guilt happening in there. So short answer, yes. It's very interesting, the shame and guilt comparison. Is there a book or additional resources to deal with guilt? Is it all right that I plug my own book here? There is a section in my book, especially for this, because I know that people really struggle with guilt, what I call the big five. So shame, guilt, anger, envy, and jealousy. So the five emotions that I think people struggle with the most. And in my book, there's a section on it, but you know, I'm sure there are other books that deal with guilt directly. If anybody has any recommendations, do pop them in the comments, and maybe we could do it for a book club. That might be good, because I think a lot of people do struggle with guilt. So Days of Dawn, so interesting. I was saying to a colleague the other day that we tend to think we should simply like or dislike others, especially senior colleagues, but there's that whole area in between. Yeah, that it's not about just fitting people into camps of yes or no, us, them, you know, that there's an entire space. It's a spectrum rather than a binary, and it's about understanding where we fit and where we might be at fault, and where we're not, you know, particularly nice people all the time. That's one of the big things, is that we often aren't very well accustomed, haven't really been introduced to, don't talk to very much, our own shadow sides, right? We all like to think that we're, you know, lovely, kind, generous, benevolent people, but we all have a shadow side. We all have a streak of meanness. We all have a streak of jealousy and envy. We all have the capacity to feel, in session, I often call it murderous rage. Do you feel like you'd like to kill her? You know, like, and it's there, and it's fine. And it's much better if you can think about it and talk about it, because in that sense, if you can process it, if you can acknowledge it, and if you can integrate it, then you don't have to cut it off and deny it, and it doesn't then emerge somewhere else in being mean to people, or in self-justification, or in some other way. So yes, that when none of us is perfect, none of us is completely devoid of human frailties, but the skill is really getting comfortable with your shadow side, with that part of you which isn't the one that you present to your partner's parents, for example, because it makes you much less anxious. To be able to know yourself to that extent makes you much less anxious, it makes you much less defended, and I think it makes you much more grounded as well. I feel like that applies to what you said about receiving criticism that doesn't define you. That generalized sense of shame or guilt is sometimes a fault of some sort of abuse in their past. What if they don't realize their connection? Yes, and I think that's absolutely true. And they often won't realize the connection, because quite often what happens with children who have been abused, or people who've experienced extensive abuse in the past, particularly where it's come from people that you should have been able to trust, or people who should have been able to protect you, is again, in a sense, that kind of cognitive dissonance where this person I love, I, you know, should be here to protect me, but this is the person that's hurting me. And how does a child resolve that? Either they say, this person can't be trusted, they're dangerous, I need to stay away from them, they are a bad person. But if they're the only person there to protect you, if they're the only one that you have to rely on, that's an impossible position. And so the resolution often for children who have experienced abuse, people who've had very abusive experiences from people who should have been protecting them, is to say, oh, I must have deserved it. It must be me. I must have started it. I must have provoked it. I must have brought it out in them. You know, they are nice until I arrived. They like everybody else. They only dislike me. So it must be me. And so it's the resolution of that dissonance, in a sense, which can lead to this internalized sense of guilt. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. Okay. You need to be so self-aware to do that, though. Yes, you do. You absolutely do. I don't underestimate it. And also, it's not very pleasant to get acquainted with your shadow side. I think Was it? Oh, it was in response to the fear question that I put in my stories a week or so ago, where I said, if it wasn't for fear, what would you do? And one person said, I would address my internalized racism. And that, you know, it's not a comfortable thing to do. It's not pleasant. It's not easy. It's very confronting. It's very, very threatening. And so with all of these very difficult, unpleasant corners of our psyches, it feels much easier to avoid it and just, whew, look over here. Let's not, you know, it's that meme where like everything's on fire and I'm just looking over here at something else completely. But what that does, the result of that is that we're always living slightly disconnected from yourself, because there's always a part of you that you're trying to hide, either from other people or from yourself. So no, it's really horrible. So yeah. All right. What else did I want to say? So the quote that I thought was really good and really something to remember: we are capable of believing things which we know to be untrue, and then when finally proved wrong, impudently twisting the facts to prove we were right. And it's just worth knowing that that's a human capacity. And if you leave with nothing but that, that's a really good place to start. You know, we have the capacity to believe things that we know are untrue. Humans are not rational. The idea that humans are rational, logical beings is just wrong. It's not true. We're driven to defend our self-concept, and we're hugely driven by unconscious and emotional processes. So the idea that you can just live life with this very calm, you know, cool prefrontal cortex way of being is wishful thinking. And so the more that you can get on board with the idea that you're likely to behave in irrational ways, particularly where there's a high threat or high emotion, is great, because then at least you can give yourself a tiny little bit of breathing space between the immediate response or the immediate trigger or event and your response. It's one of the reasons I think I did a podcast that came out this week, the Fitness Unfiltered podcast, and they said one of the questions was, do you think it's possible to have a reasonable discussion on social media? Do you like a proper debate? And I just don't. And I think partly it's because of the immediacy, because when you're having a good faith debate, you need time to mull things over. You need time to clarify your own thinking, clarify and make sure you understand what the other person's thinking and doing. You need time to kind of not be in a defense position, but actually be in the position to collaborate. But what platforms like Twitter do is say, here's a really powerful emotion, here's someone just shouting, and you have the capability to respond immediately, and your immediate response is likely to be one that is defensive and or emotionally driven. And emotions are important, but they're not a tremendous basis on which to make decisions all the time. It, you know, good decisions are a synergy between emotion and reason. But much of Twitter, for example, is mostly just emotion. So it's work though. I experienced my own train of thought trigger an anxious response. Okay, a fight or flight scenario within myself. How can I avoid falling into this without knowing what thoughts can trigger it? This is where I think it's important to talk it out with someone, because often we don't have objectivity on our own thoughts. So whether that is with a friend, whether that is with a therapist, whether that is someone whom you trust and has an opportunity to offer a different perspective, and maybe you talk through what you were thinking. I thought this, I was thinking this, and then I felt this. And then that person might say, oh, okay, well, maybe this, and they can offer you suggestions. And then it becomes a negotiation and an exploration of what was going on when you were thinking those things. I'm not, and this might just be my personal position, but I'm not convinced we can do that sort of sticky stuff completely on our own, because our risk is we kind of delude ourselves into thinking that we know ourselves like perfectly well, and most of us don't. And then the risk is that we end up in rumination, where we're just thinking over and over the same things, but without any outside light getting in. So I would talk it through with somebody else. All right. Yeah. So people become more certain they are right about something they just did if they can't undo it. A really interesting fact, and actually one that can almost be beneficial in some circumstances. So for example, you know, let's say you've been with someone for a couple of years and everything's working out well, but you're like, I don't know, shall we stay together or shall we separate? Or, you know, shall we get married or shall we leave it like this? And what they found is that once the person has proposed, then it's almost as if they just feel better, right? You've made that decision, you've eliminated the other options, and therefore you self-justify in effect. You're like, well, I've made that decision now. I'm not the kind of person who makes bad decisions, so it must be a good decision, and therefore I'm happy with it. So sometimes it works in our favor, but certainly in the book, and what they also said is that, and certainly what I see, is that you can self-justify staying in something that's no longer working, right? And that becomes part of the sunk cost fallacy, which is, I've put so much into this, whether it's a job, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a relationship, I've put so much into this. I wouldn't have put so much into this if it wasn't worthwhile, if it wasn't worth the investment. So I should just stay with it, when actually maybe it's time to stop. And so self-justification can work in both of those directions, which takes me to the other question that came in, which was how to be at peace with and commit to a decision without rehashing it. So a couple of things. One of the traps that people fall into when making decisions is believing that there is one right decision. Very, very rarely in life is that the case, that there is one right decision. When you're making decisions, A, decisions need to be a synergy between your reason and your emotion, because emotion is what gives our decisions meaning, value, and purpose. If you don't input emotion, if you don't connect with this feels good for me, this makes sense for me, this feels right, then your decisions, whether good or bad, feel valueless and you can't ever really be satisfied with them, right? So that's one part. Another part is that quite often our judgment on whether a decision is good or not, or really was good or not, is made afterwards, right? So if I leave my job and start doing something else, if I'm happy in my new job, it was a good decision. If I'm unhappy in my new job, it was a bad decision. But they come back to one central point. So you cannot know at that moment, really, whether it was a good decision. It becomes a good or bad decision depending on your analysis, your evaluation of the outcome some point later down the line, which takes me to a related point, which is that can shift depending on how far away you are from that decision point when you look back, right? So I leave my job, 6 months later, I'm absolutely miserable, so I think it's a bad decision. However, a year later, it's been the best thing that's ever happened to me, so I think it's the best decision I've ever made. So even your evaluation of whether the decision was right or not will depend on how far away you are from that decision-making point. And also to some degree, your underlying personality and attitude, right? So if you're the kind of person who thinks that the world is win or lose, black and white, and you feel worse off, then you're gonna be like, well, I've made a terrible decision. If you're more prone to optimism or realistic optimism, then you're going to say, well, I'm not happy right now, but what can I do with this? What am I learning from this? What can I take from this? So partly that, again, is going to be affected by interpersonal characteristics. So there are those caveats, but I think two big sticking points that people come up against when they're trying to make decisions is, one, is thinking that there's a perfect answer and trying to find the perfect answer and thinking, if I just think hard enough, try hard enough, work around it, list out, you know, do a pros and cons list, I can find the perfect answer. There is no perfect answer because, as I say, your evaluation about how good a decision it was will come later and will be affected by lots of different things, which is why I always recommend knowing what your values are and choosing, making a decision that's most in line with your values, right? And I think I give this example in the book. If not, I've certainly spoken about it somewhere. So again, let's think about you've got a 20-year-old and they've got two job opportunities. One is to go and work for an NGO somewhere in a country that is struggling and that they can do some good and be on the ground and support people, but it doesn't pay very well. But you're adding to the general good in humanity, right? And the other is a very well paid, quite prestigious, or like you entry level into a very prestigious job with lots of money. What's the right decision to make? Actually, none of us can know, because we don't know what that person's underlying values are, right? If that person's values are contribution, seeing the world, caring and being of service, then they should go work for an NGO. That's the right decision for them. If for them what matters is achievement, prestige, maybe they need to make money to take care of their parents or to, you know, support someone, then that's the job that they should take. So really what helps guide you towards a good decision is knowing what you stand for and knowing what's important to you, knowing your values. Your values will be your guide. And so what that helps with certainly is that even afterwards, if something goes wrong, what you can say is, well, I was living a life in tune with my values. I was following my values, and that can be some remedy. So don't assume that there's a perfect answer. Miss Cake says, can't you value both and then what? Okay, yes, but for the sake of this demonstration, you have one or the other. And then the other is getting acquainted with loss. So the other thing that really gets people stuck when we're talking about decision-making is that we don't like to experience loss. And the fundamental about any kind of decision that you make is that you will lose something, right? The existential truth is that if I choose this, then all of my other options have gone. So if I choose to be in a monogamous relationship, then I lose the option to date lots of other people. Contrary, if I choose to remain single, then I lose the things that come with being in a couple. Whenever you make a decision, you incur a loss. And if you're not someone who deals very well with loss, if you don't deal very well with disappointment, if you don't like being let down, then you can think that the problem is your decision making, when actually your problem is an intolerance of loss. And that's where you need to focus. So yeah, sorry, another really long answer to your questions. I should learn how to be succinct. All right, so passing shots, because we are rapidly running out of time. So acknowledging that cognitive dissonance and self-justification are innate tendencies, we are very, very driven to do them, and it will make us defensive, particularly where it pertains to our you're so sweet, don't be succinct. particularly where it pertains to our self-concept or our self-esteem, that we'll be very driven to self-justify. How do we start to pull ourselves out of this pit of self-justification? The things, they list a few things at the end of the book. The ones that I think I would really want to highlight are learning to tolerate dissonance. And that really does come back to the Black and White Thinking series that I did, which is you need to learn to love that place in the middle, the shades of grey. Get comfy with grey, everybody. Get on board with uncertainty. What's lovely about Black and White Thinking, what's lovely about self-justification, is that it gives you the illusion of certainty. It makes you feel like you absolutely did the right thing, you made the right choice, you're one of the good guys, everything is peachy. But what it takes you away from is the uncertainty and the capacity to think about other options, right? So if we go back to the MP example, if I am just saying, I'm right, you're wrong, the problem is the parents, my parents had difficult means and we were fine, it shuts down my ability to think that maybe other people have had different experiences from me, which shuts out the possibility to empathize with those people. So learning to tolerate dissonance and shades of gray, understanding that it's not disloyal to disagree. I think this one really, really stood out to me because it comes up a lot in therapy, which is we don't want to say that we were hurt by people, particularly this comes up a lot with family. I don't want to say that, I don't know, my mum isn't a very nice person because that would be disloyal. It's not disloyal to state facts. It's not disloyal to say how you feel, and it's not disloyal to disagree, because one of the things that allows self-justification to continue, and again, we can see it in the MP vote, is when people don't disagree. You know, so we saw 5 Conservative MPs who were like, oh, I kind of disagree. And that's seen as disloyalty. It's like, no, you're allowed to disagree. We're allowed to have different opinions. And it's about our ability to tolerate people having different opinions. And the final thing I wanted to say was that we need to like shift the way that we think about mistakes, that we don't see them as failures or signs that we've done something wrong, but, and which I think is a really beautiful thing, is to think that actually mistakes give us the opportunity to demonstrate our integrity, right? So you don't really see, I guess you can, but I think I was thinking that the way that you best see someone's integrity is their response to their own mistakes, right? So if someone really messes up or puts out some bad information, which later turns out to be wrong, or they make a very strong statement about something and then they change their mind, you get a sense, you get the best sense of their integrity when they say, I was wrong and I'm sorry and I take responsibility for it and I will do what I can to fix it and remedy it. You know, we don't look at that person as a failure and as someone to be shunned, hopefully. We look at them as someone of integrity, and we think, actually, rather than thinking that they're weak for having made a mistake, we think of them as strong for being able to stand in that error and take responsibility for it. So rather than seeing mistakes as something to be ashamed of and to self-justify your self-esteem out of, see them as an opportunity to demonstrate your integrity. All right, team, that is more than enough for a Tuesday evening. Thank you very much. I will post next month's book tomorrow, although I already have chosen what it is, and it's going to be, the book is called Fear Less by Dr. Pippa Grange. And this really picks up on the conversation we were having a little while ago about fear and the things that you guys would do if you felt less fearful. I guess I was really touched and surprised and moved by the things that you wanted to do. And I would very much like to see if we can help shift some of those fears for you. So thank you again for your kind attention and your questions and your comments and for sharing yourselves. I really appreciate it. And I will see you for next month's book club.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.